It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered. I'm home.
You're like fighting a woman?
You're saying Vince McMahon is stupid. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, my God. We're only an hour in. We have two more hours of this.
God, this dialogue is shit.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Come over here and fight me.
I'm the Solo Monster, damn it.
Solo Monster. Who are you to doubt El Dandy?
We are halfway through the WWE draft with some big names already changing t-shirts. I'm going to run down all of the moves and the ones that I think are yet to come. Why Hit Row going from NXT to the main roster concerns me. And why Becky Lynch must move to Raw tomorrow night, especially if she is not losing that SmackDown Women's Championship in Saudi Arabia in a few weeks. I've got news on the Royal Rumble and SummerSlam locations for next year. Got some thoughts on Roads to the Top. Yes, I watched it. I don't know that I'll keep watching it, but I did watch the first episode. I also watched Seth Rollins on the Broken Skull Sessions talk about what made him want to strangle Vince McMahon. That was not the only interesting takeaway from the interview. I also watched the Many Saints of Newark last night, the Sopranos prequel movie. But I'm going to save that review for YouTube a little bit later. That'll be a spoiler review. We'll save that for the YouTube channel for those of you who have an interest in that. I liked it, but I didn't love it. But we've got a ton of stuff to get into on this episode 724 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, October 3rd, 2021. I am happy to announce the new 14-year anniversary t-shirt for the Sound Off is now up on Pro Wrestling Tees in our store. We usually have a little anniversary shirt each year, so the brand new anniversary shirt is up right now, prowrestlingtees.com/Solomonster Sounds Off. 14 years coming up next month in November. We're going to be celebrating the anniversary, but you can get the t-shirt right now. You can get it in time for the anniversary next month, because with COVID and everything going on, there's some, you know, delivery delays and things of that nature. It could be a few weeks before you get your shirt. So now is the time to go ahead and order it, and I thank you to all those who do. If you want to make a PayPal donation, you may do so on thesolomonster.com. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out. You'll find the little button on the right-hand side of the page waving at you, but not really. But that's the place to go. I want to say thank you to the Portland pop star, Paul Hamilton. I hear he's on tour right now. The pop star is on tour. He's taking his act on the road. Night Stalker, Nayef Alsafar, John Loose Cannon Lopez, West Coast James Herrera, Big Bear Bryant Becerra, who is celebrating a birthday tomorrow. Happy birthday to Bryant. Out of Control, Cody Thomas, Killshot Keith Hart, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, The Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, Evil Dose, Jeff Lippman, The Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, Ostentatious, Alan Carter, John Raging Mad Riffle, B-Mac Attack, Bernard Hicks, The Alabama Assassin, Chris Young, Sweet Sapphire, Sarah Kittleson, Hard Times, Hank Spaulding, showing some love this week, as well as The Denton Destroyer, Tyler Cunningham, first-time donator to the show. Thank you, Tyler. Check out the People's Choice podcast on all major podcast platforms, but especially on YouTube. Alvin has been a fan of the Sound Off now for a very long time, and he has been grinding to grow his show to where it is today. He has interviewed over 36 guests about their journeys in life, in art, in entertainment, people from all kinds of backgrounds and industries, not just wrestling. It's like two people having a conversation and shooting the breeze, and you get to learn about a lot of very cool people. It is the People's Choice Podcast. Just search on YouTube for the People's Choice Podcast or the People's Choice Podcast channel, and it should come right up for you. I also just want to mention that the Audible link is working again. It was down for a while because of some maintenance, but if you want to get yourself a free audiobook, you've got The Death of WCW, The Young Bucks, have their book up there. Daniel Bryan, Jim Ross, Chris Jericho, AJ Lee, many years ago, came out with a book called Crazy Is My Superpower. You can get any of those books. Pick one and you get it for free when you sign up for a 30-day trial with our link, audibletrial.com/Solomonster. Every sign up helps the podcast, and every sign up, as I said, gets you one free book that you get to keep no matter what, even if you end the trial before it is over. So get on that, audibletrial.com/Solomonster. My Dark Side of the Ring review on the latest episode on Atsushi Onita and the rise and, I guess, rise and fall, you could say, and rise again of FMW, that is up on YouTube. So if you are wondering where is the review, it is on YouTube. I will probably push the audio out for you in the next day or two, but head on over to YouTube. I have that review just went up yesterday. And also, House of Glory is back. They are back with a big event coming up on Friday night, November 12th at the NYC Arena in Queens, New York. HOG Born Again. And how's this for a main event? The Amazing Red, one-on-one against Will Ospreay, the uncrowned IWGP heavyweight champion. First, second, and third row seats are completely sold out. The only tickets left are general admission for $20, and trust me, it's going to be worth it. We get to call the action live on Fight TV. For those of you who can't make the show live in person, it's going to be one hell of a night. I am looking forward to it. It is our first show in nearly 2 years, and hopefully you, either in person or on Fight, can be part of it. Again, that's on November 12th. First, I've got news to share on the locations for next year's Royal Rumble and SummerSlam. It looks like they are going to be joining WrestleMania and Money in the Bank as stadium shows. WrestleMania, of course, is going to be back in Dallas at AT&T Stadium. Money in the Bank will be at Allegiant Stadium in Las Vegas, where SummerSlam was held this year. Boy, you know, poor Survivor Series. Getting the short end of the stick here. Never gets any stadium love. All of these shows get stadium love, big domes, but never Survivor Series. For those of you wondering where in the pecking order Survivor Series ranks, this should give you a sense. But WWE announced that the 2022 Royal Rumble will take place on Saturday night. It's a Saturday Night Rumble, January 29th, from the Dome at America's Center in St. Louis, Missouri. AEW took the Full Gear pay-per-view away from St. Louis, and here comes WWE to the rescue with a Royal Rumble. They can fit over 40,000 in there for basketball games and well over 60,000 for football games, so that gives you a range of what they're looking at. Probably, probably in the 50 to 60,000 range. The stadium rumbles have been fun the past few years from baseball stadiums. This is a little bit different, but it is a huge venue. It's going to be on a Saturday because the NFC and AFC championship games are that Sunday. And they do not want any of the NFL playoffs. So Friday, October 15th at 11 a.m. Eastern is the ticket on sale date if you want to try to nab a ticket to the Royal Rumble. I've been to a couple of Royal Rumbles before. One in Madison Square Garden back in 2008. That was the one where John Cena made the big surprise comeback at number 30. And that was a lot of fun. It's always fun to be there and count down and everything. I was in Orlando for the one in 2016 that came down to Triple H and Dean Ambrose. A lot of people turned their back on Triple H when the match was over and he won. Literally turned around and turned their back. But that was fun. That was the night that AJ Styles made his debut in the Royal Rumble match. And TalkSport is reporting that WWE is looking to bring its first major show to the United Kingdom in 30 years next year, likely for SummerSlam, 30 years after SummerSlam 1992 was held at Wembley Stadium. I cannot tell you how many emails I have gotten over the years that I have been doing this podcast asking me if WWE is ever going to bring another big event like WrestleMania or SummerSlam back to the UK. Are they ever going to come back? They have not been back since 92 for a major pay-per-view. They've had other events, they've had UK-only shows, but never a major pay-per-view like one of the big four, one of the big five, which is hard to believe considering they put 80,000 people in that stadium that year, which no longer exists. The original Wembley was demolished almost 20 years ago. That pay-per-view aired on a delay here in the States. It aired 2 days later. The time zone difference scared them off from doing another one. And that was before the internet. So imagine now, you know, how skittish they would be to do a show that is taped, you know, 24 hours beforehand or however long beforehand, where spoilers and photos and videos can more easily leak. You didn't have that issue in 92. And it's still part of what scared them off after that from doing another one, but it looks like this might finally be happening. You know, Triple H was just quoted in April. It wasn't that long ago. It was earlier this year. He was quoted in The Sun, and I know it's The Sun. I know it's garbage, but he was interviewed, and he claimed the reason they haven't gone back to the UK for a major show is because it didn't make any money. He claimed that SummerSlam 92 did not make the company any money, any real money. So I wonder what changed. He just said this in April. What changed between then and now? Based on this report, it does not sound like the new Wembley Stadium is the leading candidate. It is a candidate. It is a possibility. The new Wembley has a capacity of about 90,000. The leading contender, though, seems to be Cardiff's Principality Stadium, which has a retractable roof, which is very attractive to them, and can fit over 70,000 people. But this is not a done deal. This is not anything that is near the finish line. It is said to be in the discussion stage, the exploration phase. Vince McMahon is playing the role of Ferdinand Magellan. He is exploring. But, you know, with the network, things are very different now than they used to be. Now they have Saturday shows. You know, they have Saudi Arabia shows that air in the U.S. at 1 o'clock in the afternoon on a Thursday, like the next one coming up in a few weeks. So, I mean, there really is no excuse for them not to do another big U.K. show. They have some of the loudest, most passionate fans in the world over there. I think of the U.K. fans the way I think of the fans up in Canada. And when they're starved for a major event and WWE goes in there, those fans are as loud can be. The energy, you know, it's great. It makes for a great atmosphere. Now imagine how starved that the UK crowd is going to be for a show like this. How loud they'll probably be for that show. Now on the AEW side, the Full Gear pay-per-view next month that was originally scheduled for St. Louis on November 6th. Will now be taking place 1 week later from the Target Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota, as will Rampage the night before, which I will not be reviewing live that night since I'll be at the House of Glory show. But Rampage will be there the night before as well. The reason they moved the pay-per-view, they want nothing to do with the Canelo Alvarez fight or the UFC pay-per-view from Madison Square Garden on the 6th. And I don't blame them. I would have done the same thing. I know people in St. Louis were very upset who bought tickets and everything, but if I were Tony Khan and I booked this show and only after the fact that I realize, oh shit, there's a big boxing fight and a big UFC show that night, I would have done the exact same thing and moved the show right out of there. And they'll have more tickets to sell because the Target Center is a bigger building than the Chaffetz Arena, which can fit around 10,000. In the Target Center, it's an NBA building, so they could probably fit. I mean, I would guess with the stage and the setup and everything, they could probably get a good 15,000 people in that building. Now on Twitter, a fan replied to AEW's tweet about tickets going on sale for Full Gear, and this person suggested that they host Dynamite the week after from the Mall of America, which is in Minnesota. The Mall of America, I believe, is in Bloomington. And whoever runs the Mall of America Twitter account responded and said, we're all for it. It worked great the first time. AEW brings the fire. And look, I'm all for unique venues. I would love to see Dynamite or Rampage or both 1 week from the Mall of America. I mean, you just know Darby Allin would be doing a coffin drop from one level up down to the ring. I'm sure they can make good use of the environment there. So I'm all for it if they can pull it off. It's just too bad the power of Pasta Mania is not there anymore, like it was when Nitro ran there in 95. And you remember last week I talked about how I would love to see AEW book the Hammerstein Ballroom in New York City for a show. I just talked about this last week, and it looks like they may have been beaten to the punch by GCW. Owner Brett Lauderdale posted a photo on his Twitter account this week from an ECW show back in the day at the Hammerstein. No context, no caption, just a picture. PW Insider inquired with the venue about this, and they did say they have no wrestling shows scheduled on the calendar, but they did confirm that a wrestling promotion, they wouldn't say which one, did a site survey recently at the building. It doesn't look like it was AEW, though, if this tweet means anything. You know, more and more, I look at the wrestling landscape as it is right now. You've got WWE, and you've got AEW as the big two. You know, basically, it's like WWF and WCW back in the day. And the closest thing to what ECW used to be is GCW. They do an incredible job of getting people talking about them online with their shows. And their next one is coming up this Saturday with Jon Moxley defending the GCW title against Nick Gage. And Mick Foley is going to be there to present the GCW title before the main event. They are completely sold out for the show in Atlantic City. The only way to watch it is live on Fight TV. And they have just done, I think, again, an incredible job of creating a buzz around their brand and around their company and packing in houses in these small venues. But a lot of people, more and more people, have been talking about GCW and, you know, recognizing, oh, what is this GCW thing, and checking out their shows. So there's a certain buzz in the air for them that does remind me a lot of ECW when they were on the rise back in the mid-90s. And MLW held its Fightland show last night at the old ECW Arena, speaking of ECW, which is now called the 2300 Arena in Philly. There was a big main event with Jacob Fatu 819 days deep into his reign as the MLW World Champion, defending his title against the MLW National Openweight Champion Alex Hammerstone, title for title. I will not spoil anything. I will not give away any of the match results here. The match is not going to air until this Thursday at 10 p.m. Eastern on Vice. I heard great things about it, but what caught my eye the most, and I don't think I'm not aware of this airing this week on TV, but what caught my eye the most was the MLW debut at these tapings of Carly Perez, Katrina, from Lucha Underground, once again managing Mil Muertes, who now goes by the name King Muertes. They have been reunited again. They are going to be part of the Azteca Underground programming that MLW is doing, which is what they brought Dario Cueto in for, who now goes by the name of Cesar Duran. They can't use any of the old names because they don't own them, but this is the closest thing to a Lucha Underground revival that we're ever going to get. So that was very cool. I saw some pictures pop up online of Carly. I guess that's the name she's going to go by. Katrina. She'll always be Katrina to me. But I saw the pictures of her and Muertes together, and it just filled my heart with joy to see them reunited again. It's very cool. Now, I want to talk about Monday Night Raw. And I've got some breaking news here. You're not going to believe this. I've got some breaking news concerning Monday Night Raw. I actually enjoyed Monday Night Raw for the most part this past week. No, I'm not sick. I'm not running a fever. I'm not delirious or delusional or on medication or anything like that. I don't get to say that very often. So I wanted the world to hear it. You know there must be a new season of Stranger Things coming soon because we're in the Upside Down when Solomonster has a lot of positive things to say about Monday Night Raw. You know, when they let the wrestling carry the show as they did this week, it's usually a very strong effort. It's when they muddy it up with their terrible creative that things usually go sideways. But this week they opened and then they closed with the WWE Championship being defended. They gave us a fun match between AJ Styles and Matt Riddle and a great United States title match between Sheamus and Damian Priest that was, frankly, more extreme than anything we saw at Extreme Rules. We got two things on this show that I had just asked for and pitched on the podcast last week. This is happening a lot lately, by the way. Pitching various things and then boom, there it is. But there were two things last week that I had pitched. One was a Hurt Business reunion, which is what we got on this show. And I also said it's time to get Keith Lee back on TV. Like, ASAP. And there he was. On my television on Monday night, Keith Lee was back doing what Keith Lee should be doing. Throwing people around and squashing them. And even Goldberg was on this show in video form. Even the Bill Goldberg promo from his home did not offend me. Because we know this time around he is not wrestling for the WWE Championship. That was my biggest gripe with him coming back in the first place and wrestling Lashley, was that it was for the title and it never needed to be for the title. It didn't make sense for it to be for the title. He should not have been wrestling for the championship. And now he isn't. There was no Alexa Bliss on the show after her loss to Charlotte at Extreme Rules and her meltdown when Charlotte tore Lily the Doll to shreds. PW Insider says that Alexa is taking time off to undergo sinus surgery, so she probably will be gone for a little bit. But she posted a quote from Albert Einstein on her Twitter that has me a little worried. Energy cannot be created or destroyed. It can only be changed from one form to another. That has me worried. That Lily may soon take her human form. Now that she is dead in doll form, she may be taking a different form soon. This story may be continuing. I hope Dakota Kai is ready for her name change soon. They open the show with a WWE title match between Big E and Bobby Lashley. They were trying to get the jump start on Monday Night Football. They were having a good match, but those 10 minutes were just meant to set up a longer main event inside of a steel cage at the end of the show. So between this match and the main event later, they actually went about 26 minutes. But anyway, it's a good thing too, because they just so happened to have a cage tarped and hanging above the ring at the beginning of the show. I don't know what they would have done if they didn't. Big E got thrown outside the ring at one point. Right at his feet were Shelton Benjamin and Cedric Alexander wearing Hurt Business t-shirts. They are back. And it might not make any sense seeing as how they broke up and they all said the things that they said to each other and Lashley destroyed them both. But I'm willing to look past that because they righted their, at least for 1 week. I don't want to give them too much credit yet because they could undo all of this in 24 hours. But they righted the wrong that they made. It was wrong when they did it, and it was wrong in hindsight looking back at Vince McMahon's decision. And it was Vince McMahon's decision that they supposedly met with him and they fought it tooth and nail, but it was his call to break up the Hurt Business. He was wrong to do it. Kofi Kingston and Xavier Woods came out to go after Shelton and Cedric, and their brawling spilled into the ring. That caused a disqualification. Adam Pearce came out to announce a cage match for later in the night to try to keep anybody from getting involved. Second week in a row that they have opened with their main event and did a finish designed to set up a bigger, unannounced main event. But it's that time of year when they try those things because they know they're going to get slaughtered. They're going to get shellacked by football. Angel Garza beat Eric of the Viking Raiders with the wing clipper. The push continues for Garza and Humberto Carrillo, who is out there with him. Those two could be a great fixture in the tag team division if they really believe in them. We've just seen so many of these start and stop pushes, even with these two guys, that I am taking an I'll believe it when I see it approach here. But I like that they're at least seemingly making an effort with them. They actually got me to not fast forward this week through a 24/7 title match between Reginald and Ricochet. I thought to myself, this could be a fun video game match to watch. These two are just going to be bouncing all over the place like a pinball machine. And then it was over in 90 seconds, and it ended in a disqualification. And I said, I won't let myself fall for that ever again. Fuck this. I'm out. So no more 24/7 garbage for me. I gave them a shot. They fucked me. I'm done. They had a chance to hook me in here with a match that actually looked kind of interesting, and they fucked it all up, so they can kiss my ass. Keith Lee is officially Keith Bearcat Lee. So we now know the name. It has stuck. They are using it on television. He's got new tights that have a claw scratch on them, and it says Bearcat on it. I don't give a shit. He's back on TV. He had a pissed off look on his face. We didn't get greetings and salutations, Keith Lee, which is not the Keith Lee that we should be getting, like he's out there reciting a fucking poem. We got, I don't get paid by the hour, let me kill you, little jobber, and hit the showers, Keith Lee, who threw Akira Tozawa around like a tennis ball and gave him his BBC for the win. If giving him a nickname is going to get Vince McMahon interested in pushing Keith Lee as a monster, then you can call him whatever you want to. You can call him Bearcat, you can call him Bareback, call him whatever the fuck you want. I don't care. I want more of this Keith Lee on my TV. Sheamus and Damian Priest. I know they didn't want Jeff Hardy in the match, getting more cheers than Priest, which is what happened at the pay-per-view. But if you think about this logically, Sheamus is the one who took the fall, the losing fall, the night before, not Jeff Hardy. It should have been Jeff Hardy getting a singles match against Damian Priest and not Sheamus. But be that as it may, these two, I think, are incapable of having a bad match together. And Sheamus, once again, as I have been saying for months, is the unsung MVP of this show in that ring. Although now I think people are starting to sing the song of Sheamus. The man has been great. This was no disqualification, no count out for the United States Championship, and was the Extreme Rules match that we did not get the night before. There was a white noise spot that looked awful for Priest to take, for Damian Priest in his shoulder, off the ring apron through a table down below. There were kendo sticks, there were chairs, there were more tables. Priest was all cut up and bloody on his back. Sheamus, when he takes those kendo stick shots, it's a great visual because you can see the welts on his pasty white albino skin. They start showing right away. These two beat the crap out of each other. And it was another strong win for Damian Priest in a string of strong wins lately. He is getting more over with each passing week. Unfortunately, Sheamus has had terrible luck with his broken nose, and he tweeted a photo before, a few days ago, going into surgery. I think that was on Wednesday. Guy's gonna have to wear that face mask for the rest of his career. Like Bob Orton and the cast on his arm. Jinder Mahal was back with Veer and Shanky. They picked up a win over Jeff Hardy, Mustafa Ali, and Mansoor. Veer picked up the win. He wound up with his arm. He was winding up like a baseball pitcher. And he threw a lariat that turned Ali inside out before he pinned him. They were playing off of Veer's past as the first Indian-born man to ever play professional baseball. He was signed by the Pittsburgh Pirates. He pitched in the minor leagues. Why not give us a background feature on him? Because right now, he's just Veer. He's one of Jinder Mahal's lackeys, and there's no color to this guy. There's no reason to be interested in who he is or where he's from, because the average viewer has no idea. All they know is that, oh look, it's Veer. I'd rather have Veal, not Veer. But people haven't been given a reason to care. Give us a reason to care when we see this man on TV, even if he's supposed to be a heel. I'm not saying that you should put together some heroic babyface package, but at least let us know what this guy's background is. I think people would find it very interesting to find out that he comes from a baseball background. AJ Styles beat Matt Riddle with a burning hammer and a Styles Clash. If Riddle would have kicked out of that burning hammer, I was about to go off. But thankfully, he didn't. Just a great match. AJ reminds us, even though he has been relegated to tag team duty, that he is still one of the best in the entire company. Charlotte Flair pinned Doudrop to retain the Raw Women's title off a distraction from Eva Marie. This went less than 2 minutes. This sucked. This was very dumb, the way they did this. And when Eva got in the ring after to gloat, Charlotte laid her out too. After a break, They come back, and I'm going to get back to Eva here in a second. But after a break, they come back, and they have a taped promo from Bill Goldberg at Casa Goldberg. And he spoke very calmly and very deliberately. He didn't yell and scream and snort like he usually does. He didn't buy the excuse that what Bobby Lashley did to Sundberg at SummerSlam was a misunderstanding. He said Lashley hurt his boy, and now he's going to hurt Lashley. And his exact quote was, "Hell, if I'm lucky enough, I'll even kill you." Threatening death upon Bobby Lashley. Which, if somebody put their hands on my kid, I would do the same thing. But I heard that and I thought, well, that escalated quickly. But it kind of makes sense. He said Gage is his son and Lashley is about to be his... I thought he was going to say bitch. Everybody loves saying bitch on this show, but he didn't. He said victim. He said Lashley is going to be his victim. Now, this is not official yet, but obviously the match is going to be made official for sweet Saudi money in a few weeks. And I like that there's no title at stake this time. What I don't like is that Lashley is probably headed for another loss at a time when he has been losing a lot. He lost on this show. Without the title at stake and Goldberg defending his son, I think it is highly unlikely that Bobby Lashley walks out of that pay-per-view with a win. Now, after this, they come back live to the ring, and Eva Marie is still in the ring, and she had a microphone in her hand. They do this all the time, where they make the person stand in the ring in the dark, while other segments play on the Tron in the arena, and the person just looks like a fucking idiot, just standing around, diddling themselves. So after Eva was done diddling herself, she was back on TV, and she said that she would be the Raw Women's Champion right now, if it was her in there against Charlotte Flair and not Doudrop. All of a sudden, out comes the biggest babyface in the women's division, second only to Charlotte Flair after ripping that doll to shreds, Shayna Baszler. Shayna the Destroyer. Fresh off putting Nia Jax on the injured reserve list, out to do the same to Eva Marie. She choked her out, she rolled her out to the floor, she placed her arm on top of the ring steps, and she stomped on it. And Eva screamed and cried like her arm was broken, and the crowd was so distraught by this evil act, this heinous act, so disturbing, that they chanted one more time. They wanted her to do it again, but she didn't. Shane is breaking more arms lately than Pentagon did on Lucha Underground. I love it. More of this. Shayna Baszler, and she'll be as over as anybody on this show. I just don't know if they want her to be as over as anybody on this show. But I want her to kill all of the acts that annoy me. She got rid of Nia Jax. Hopefully she got rid of Eva Marie. I'm trying to think, what else annoys me on this show? We'll put Shayna Baszler in there with them. Let her get rid of them, too. They came back at the end of the show with Big E and Bobby Lashley in a cage for the championship. This time they went over 15 minutes and had another strong effort. The Hurt Business did come out again, so Kofi and Woods did the same. Woods slammed the cage door on Lashley's head. Kofi did a truss dive off the side of the cage down onto Benjamin and Alexander. All four were ejected, and Big E ended up winning with a big ending off the ropes. Got the decisive pin. After the match, Drew McIntyre's music played and he pointed his sword at Big E, teasing a match as they went off the air. If they're going to do the match, they better get it done in the next 3 weeks because Drew McIntyre is headed to SmackDown, as predicted. And on the subject of SmackDown, it was night one of the WWE draft. I already did a full review of the show on YouTube Friday night. I figured it's a special show, it's a draft night show, so we'll do a super stream, we'll talk about SmackDown and Rampage. So if you want the full review of the entire show, top to bottom, that's where to find it. Brock Lesnar, I'll give you the short of it here. Brock Lesnar was in the house, creating more drama between Roman Reigns and Paul Heyman, and announcing that he is now a free agent who can do what he wants, which is no different really than the last 9 years that he has been with this company. Roman Reigns is sending Paul Heyman to Raw tomorrow night to make sure that the Usos are drafted to SmackDown. And he is sending Jimmy and Jay with him, and Heyman, if he doesn't get the job done, Reigns told the Usos, leave him for dead. Speaking of being left for dead, Kevin Owens, he lost to Happy Corbin, clean in the middle of the ring, in the most anticlimactic way possible. They're calling the end of days now Happy Days, which I do think that's clever. But it really does feel like Kevin Owens is out of there when his contract is up at the end of January. I mean, there's still time between now and then, although not as much as you may think. It's already October. It's not a long time. But I think KO is as good as gone. Seth Rollins broke into Edge's house in North Carolina while Edge was in the ring in Baltimore at the building. Edge's response to this was to phone his neighbors, Daniel and David, Dash and Dawson. Legitimately his neighbors. He decided to phone them instead, or tell Beth Phoenix, I talked to Daniel and Dave, instead of calling the police. Edge apparently does not trust law enforcement to do their job. And we got a rematch of one of the main events of this year's WrestleMania, the match that we were supposed to get at SummerSlam between Sasha Banks and Bianca Belair, which Sasha won after Becky Lynch got involved. Just watch the WrestleMania match. It was much better than this. Makes me very sad that we never got a proper rematch between these two. But the newsworthy parts of the show were the segments with Adam Pearce and Sonya Deville announcing the first four rounds of draft picks. The rules of the draft this year are as follows. Half the roster was eligible on Friday with the other half eligible on Raw tomorrow night in Nashville. That includes talents from the NXT brand. Who are all the eligible names? Well, don't ask me because WWE hasn't bothered to put the pools up. I doubt they even know yet. All of the names that are eligible. We can figure out who's going to be eligible, some of the names, just based on who wasn't drafted on Friday, but that's not everybody. Draft changes do not officially go into effect until the night after Crown Jewel, which would be SmackDown on October 22nd. So that gives them 3 weeks to tie up any loose ends as far as storylines and titles are concerned. And talents that go undrafted, like the last kid picked for the dodgeball team, will become free agents and they can sign with any brand that they wish. There were around 20 additional picks that they announced on Talking Smack yesterday as well. So let's just run through all of the draft picks so far, and then I'll kind of tackle some of these. Monday Night Raw, so far, has drafted WWE Champion Big E, Bianca Belair, the Raw Tag Team Champions Randy Orton and Matt Riddle, Edge, Women's Tag Team Champions Rhea Ripley and Nikki Cross, Keith Bearcat Lee, Rey and Dominic Mysterio, Austin Theory from NXT, Drake Maverick from NXT, Nia Jax, John Morrison, Zelina Vega, Otis and Chad Gable. So the Alpha Academy is moving from Fridays to Mondays. Apollo Crews, Commander Aziz, Doudrop, Akira Tozawa, T-Bar, R-Truth, Reginald, and I guess the 24/7 crap belt goes with him. So those are the Raw moves so far. Over on the SmackDown side, they have Roman Reigns, Charlotte Flair, who is moving from Raw to SmackDown, Drew McIntyre, Kofi Kingston and Xavier Woods, Happy Corbin and his new sidekick, Riddick Moss, who is now going by the name Madcap Moss, Hit Row from NXT, that is Isaiah Swerve Scott, who is still the North American champion in NXT, Ashanti the Adonis, Top Dollar, and B-Fab, or I think as Sonya Deville called him, Top Dollar, in the whitest way possible. I'm about as white as they come, and even I say Top Dollar. You gotta say it the right way. Top Dollar. Not Top Dollar. Naomi, Jeff Hardy, Aaliyah from NXT, Drew Gulak, Mace, so Mace and T-Bar are no more. They were the last remnants of Retribution. And they are no more. Mansoor, Mustafa Ali, and Tony Storm. Those are the SmackDown moves. Charlotte Flair is the Raw Women's Champion. She is headed to SmackDown. It's a move that Fox reportedly asked for. They wanted Charlotte. They requested Charlotte on the show. Charlotte does need new faces to work with. There were barely any of them left on Mondays. We just don't know how they're going to handle the title situation. You know, are they just going to go the cheap and easy route and just swap the red and blue belts the way they did last year with the New Day and the Street Profits? Because I think that would be incredibly fucking lame and lazy. Not that they haven't done that before. I don't like that. Charlotte still has 3 weeks to drop that championship. I don't see what the big deal is. I mean, you know they want to pad her title reigns. So let her drop it. We all know she's going to end up being the SmackDown Women's Champion in a matter of months anyway. And then she'll go from 12 to 13, 13 to 14, and so on until she eventually breaks her father's record. He who shall not be mentioned at the moment. He is persona non grata in that company. But if it were me, she got 3 weeks to drop that championship. I think that they should consider having her drop it to Shayna Baszler. Now, it all depends on how things go at Crown Jewel with Becky and Bianca and Sasha, because they announced this week they're going to have a triple threat for the SmackDown Women's title. So it is also possible that Bianca Belair will leave the SmackDown Women's Champion, and in fact, her and Charlotte will simply swap belts, and Bianca will officially be the Raw Women's Champion, and Charlotte will be the SmackDown Women's Champion. That probably is the leading candidate for what they are going to do, the leading option that they are likely to choose. But I put the idea out there. I like what they have been doing with Shayna Baszler the last few weeks. This is the Shayna Baszler from NXT that we saw a long time ago. There is time to build to a Raw Women's title match and have her beat Charlotte Flair and have Charlotte put Shayna over. It's not just a matter of giving Shayna the belt. It's a matter of her getting a win over Charlotte would be a big deal for Shayna Baszler. You want to really get this woman over as a killer? You want to show us that this push is real and that we should take it seriously and pay attention? Well, that's the best way possible that you can convince me that you're all in on Shayna Baszler. Now, with that move, all four of the horsewomen from NXT are now on SmackDown. And that ain't going to last very long. I think 48 hours from now, we're going to be singing a different tune. But for the time being, Charlotte, Sasha, Becky, and Bayley are all on the SmackDown brand, but I don't expect that to last. With Bianca Belair moving to Raw, I expect the Street Profits to follow tomorrow night. I think the Usos clearly are going to stay on Friday. Street Profits move to Mondays. But unless she drops the championship in Saudi Arabia, one move that absolutely needs to happen is Becky Lynch following Bianca to Monday Night Raw. And if Becky goes to Raw, so too does Seth Rollins. But Becky better move to Raw, because if they moved Bianca Belair and they do not move Becky Lynch, I want to hear from all these people after SummerSlam who said, oh, let it play out, let it play out, just let things play out. Bianca's going to end up on top with Becky. Just let it play out. That's going to be awfully hard if they're no longer on the same brand. So either Becky drops the belt to Bianca in 3 weeks in the triple threat, or she moves to Raw, because if she doesn't, if she keeps the title and she moves to Raw and Bianca doesn't, then what they did at SummerSlam was even worse than we all thought. Drew McIntyre goes to SmackDown. That was the top move that I pitched. And what it does is it sets up a future rematch, at least one, between Drew McIntyre and Roman Reigns. I loved their match at Survivor Series last year. I thought it was an excellent match. It was an excellent little appetizer to the eventual entree, which could very well be a WrestleMania main event. They could be setting up for Roman Reigns to challenge Drew McIntyre, possibly even drop the Universal title to Drew McIntyre at WrestleMania if they can't get a bigger name, because I'm sure they'd love to have The Rock, but the odds are against that happening, I would think. But McIntyre needed to move. He's put over Damian Priest, he lost to Sheamus, he's been doing a lot of losing. And clearly he was not factored into the WWE title picture going forward because he was in it for so long. You know, you got to move on and get some new faces in there. And now Big E is going to have a chance to carry it for a while. Drew McIntyre going to SmackDown is the move that made the most sense for Drew McIntyre. With Kofi and Woods moving back to SmackDown, that makes it the second straight draft they have split up the New Day after their brief reunion on Raw. Big E does not need Kofi Kingston and Xavier Woods with him to succeed as WWE champion. Big E, I think, will be just fine. He was doing well on SmackDown without them. but it is really too bad that they fumbled what should have been a special match that meant a lot more than it did between the New Day and the Bloodline at Survivor Series. That's the match that should have happened in the location and on the show that it should have happened. I mean, it happened, but it didn't happen the way that it should have. They threw it out there, and it was kind of a waste. But they still want to do the whole Raw versus SmackDown stuff at Survivor Series, so that would not have been possible if they booked a six-man tag as an elimination match like I had originally pitched. Jeff Hardy going to SmackDown is one of the draft picks I also had recommended on the podcast, so I like that move. I'm telling you, there is a program just waiting for them with Jeff Hardy and Roman Reigns. I hope they didn't just move Jeff Hardy over to be the job guy and the fall guy for a whole crop of different people on Fridays instead of doing that on Mondays. And in fact, if they go with Roman Reigns and Drew McIntyre, let's just say, at WrestleMania, and decide not to circle back to Reigns and Lesnar after the Crown Jewel match, because they could always come back and do Roman and Brock again at WrestleMania. Just because they're doing it in a few weeks doesn't mean that that can't be the WrestleMania main event. We don't know how things are going to play out, you know, in 3 weeks. But let's say they don't do that, and they do Reigns and McIntyre. I would do a program with Hardy first. Hardy can be the setup guy for that. It's a babyface for Roman to work with for a couple of months before getting to whoever the top challenger is going to be at WrestleMania. And so now, you know, in 3 weeks, I guess, when he goes to SmackDown, now is the time to let Jeff start racking up some wins week by week. And then eventually he gets to Roman Reigns. You get a couple of pay-per-view matches out of it. You could do one straight match. Maybe it has a funky finish. You do a rematch, just like they did with Reigns and Balor. Maybe the second match is a ladder match, right? That's a Jeff Hardy specialty. And then Reigns moves on to Drew. Lesnar being a free agent means that he could go wherever he wants. So they could do Lesnar against Lashley at WrestleMania as something of like a co-main event if Brock is not going to be challenging for the championship. But one of the other big moves in this draft, and it's been somewhat polarizing, I think, depending on who you read or have heard from, is Hit Row, which has been one of my favorite acts on NXT for a while. For the longest time, Swerve Scott was sort of this boat that was drifting. The waves were carrying him around, and he was just directionless. He didn't really know where he was headed. He was just kind of floating on the water. And then this Hit Row thing sort of came out of nowhere. They put these four together, him, Top Dollar, who had not been on TV before, unless you count the Hidden Treasure show, where he offered $2,000 for almost everything, no matter what piece of memorabilia it was. We'll give you $2,000. I can't do more than that. I got a budget. But, you know, he was added to that group, and I think he has done a good job as well. And Ashanti the Adonis was added to the group, and B-Fab. And I love the segments where Swerve would be in his recording studio and the way they would shoot it. Like, it just looked cool. There was a cool factor about these four being together. It just works. And now they're going to be headed to the main roster. And I have the same concerns with them heading to the main roster as I would have with anybody heading to the main roster. Is that you never know what you are going to get. It's like that fucking box of chocolates from Forrest Gump. You can't be sure what you're going to get when somebody gets the call and says, hey, you're coming to Raw. You're coming to SmackDown. Sometimes it works out okay. And I hold up Damian Priest as an example of that. Damian Priest, I give them credit. What they're doing with him is pitch perfect. They're taking their time with him. He's got that United States Championship. He's racking up a lot of credible victories over credible names like Drew McIntyre, like Jeff Hardy, like Sheamus. He's going in there. He's having great matches. He's not, you know, cruising on by. He's going in there and getting the hell beaten out of him. He's having some real hard matches where it feels like when it's over, he earned the win. He went in there and it was like he was in a fight, especially when you're in there with Sheamus. You come out of it a little worse for wear. But what they're doing with him is a great example. And I look at that and I just go, not everybody is going to get over the way that a Damian Priest is getting over. And I think Damian Priest can be a world champion one day. Not everybody who gets called up from NXT is going to be the world heavyweight champion. But I look at what they've done with him and I say, why can't they do that with a lot of the other people that they call up? Why is it so hard? Why do they not believe in a lot of these people? Or claim they do and then they get bored? Why? Is it because Priest is tall and he's going to get better, more opportunities because he looks the part? Because he checks off all the size requirements? Is that what it is? Someone like B-Fab, who I think personality-wise is great. She's a great fit for this group. And I absolutely enjoy seeing her on TV when they have those segments, whether it's at the recording studio or she's just out there cutting a promo, whatever it may be, in a match, she's pulling someone's leg and trying to get involved. We've now seen B-Fab in two matches on TV each of the last 2 weeks. And the verdict on B-Fab, and I'll talk about NXT in a little bit when I do the review for Tuesday's show, she had a match this week against Electra Lopez, who is also someone new that we haven't seen a lot on TV. I've seen B-Fab in the ring twice, and it's not pretty. She's not ready. In the ring, she needs a lot of work. She's just not that good. I'm guessing she just hasn't had a lot of experience. So far, doing matches in front of, you know, an audience and everything. So, she is not ready for prime time when it comes to being in the ring. If their plan for her is to be part of this group, and really not do a lot of wrestling at first, continue to train, continue to learn, focus more on just her as a character and a personality and a presence as part of this group, and let you know, Swerve Scott, for example, do the majority of the wrestling, then that's okay. Because he's more than ready. Swerve, I don't think anybody can debate about the fact that, you know, Shane Strickland is ready to be on Raw or SmackDown. B-Fab is not ready as far as being in the ring. Ashanti the Adonis, from what I've seen of him, he's good. I don't really have an opinion one way or the other on whether or not he's ready. I think he'll be okay. Top Dollar sort of falls into that camp of great personality, great talker. The way that they've kind of booked him in matches where he shows off his power, you know, he's power slamming 2-3 guys at a time. I think that'll get over. It's really B-Fab, of all the ones in the group, who I think needs a lot more seasoning before she's ready to be in the ring. We don't know what their plans are for her. Maybe they call up Hit Row and they want to take B-Fab and make her the big star. You know, that's kind of what happened with Sanity. When they called up Sanity, it was Nikki Cross. You look at all the members of that group and look who's the last one standing. It's Nikki Cross. Sanity never had a shot. You talk about factions that got called up from NXT that were never even given a chance. They got called up to SmackDown. They were fucked from day one. All I can do is hope that that does not happen. That fate does not befall Hit Row. Because I want to see them succeed. It is a hot act. It is a money act. And I think they could get over in front of that audience. I don't think they would have an issue doing it. I think they'll get over. Swerve Scott, we know he can carry his end in the ring. What happens with the North American title? Does he drop it to someone like Santos Escobar first? Does he just give it up? We've seen that before. Asuka, remember Asuka and other people who have been called up have just sort of given up. They've surrendered their championships and then they're declared vacant. Swerve Scott never really had a chance to show what he can do as the North American champion. How many title matches has he even had? How many title defenses of that belt has he had? Has he had one? He might have had one. I can't think of very many. If you ask me to name one, I can't even name one. I vaguely think there might have been one, but that tells you something right there. So he never even had a chance to have much of a run with that championship. After he took it, you know, Bronson Reed was the North American champion. He didn't have it for very long, and now he's out of a job. That North American title has been somewhat cursed in a way, it feels like, recently. But all I can say about Hit Row is this. Top Dollar went on Twitter. He said, "Stop comparing us to other people who couldn't transition to the main roster. We can promo." And how much of that was in character, how much of that was real, I'm sure a lot of that was real. Because I have seen a lot of comments online complaining about the fact that Hit Row got called up, they're not ready, and this and that. And I'm sure it gets to them. I'm sure that comment, as much as it being in character, a lot of that was real. A lot of what he tweeted out there. But when he goes on Twitter and he says something, stop comparing us to other people who couldn't transition to the main roster, I take that also as such a slap in the fucking face to people who, and I just mentioned Sanity as one example, who got called up to the main roster. And if you're someone like that, and a lot of those guys don't even have a job in this company anymore, and it's not necessarily because they weren't talented, they got signed for a reason. WWE signed them and was paying them not because they felt charitable. It's because they saw something in them at that time, and so they gave them a contract, and they brought them in, and they had something to bring to the table, whether it was on the microphone or in the ring or in some other capacity. Things didn't work out. They lost their job. Here's Top Dollar going on Twitter and saying, well, those people couldn't cut it, is what he's saying. And to me, that is such a dick thing for him to say. Yeah, there are some people who can't cut it. A lot of those people, though, who were never really given a chance and ended up not succeeding, it was not through anything that they did wrong. It was because they never got a fair shake. And I'm sure we could sit here and think of a whole bunch of names that would fall into that category. Why is Bronson Reed no longer employed by WWE? Why is he sitting home waiting to be picked up by another promotion, waiting to get back out there and get back into the ring? What was wrong with Bronson Reed? They belted him. They put the North American title on him, just like they did to his buddy Swerve. And then he lost it and he got fired. Now, why is that? Because he wasn't good enough? You're going to tell me he wasn't good enough? Say that to him. I'm sure he'll have something to say about that. It just came across as such a smug dick thing for him to say. As if everybody who gets moved from NXT to the main roster who doesn't work out, well, it's all their fault. We'll see if he's singing that same tune in 6 months, depending on how things work out with Hit Row. We'll revisit that comment in 6 months and see if he still feels the same way. All I'm going to say is, I hope they succeed. I just hope the people who are going to be pulling the strings now behind the scenes and running things there on SmackDown, there's a very different crew from NXT. You know, you also talk about scripted promos and lines that they might want them to recite and stuff. And it's going to be very easy to tell if Hit Row is being coached more and more on what to say in terms of their verbiage. Do their promos change a lot? Or does it sound like the same Hit Row that we have seen for months now on NXT? He seems to think, if you listen to Mr. Francis over here, they're not going to be scripted. It's going to be Hit Row as you remember Hit Row. Okay. All right. I'm sure everybody has that attitude before they go to the main roster. We'll see. I don't need a backstage source to tell me. I'm going to watch and I'm going to listen to their promos and I'll be able to hear with my own two ears. And we'll see if things look and sound any different for Hit Row than they did in NXT. For their sake, I hope he's right. He seems to be very confident, this guy. I hope he's right. Now, after the first half of the draft, both shows are pretty evenly matched. The Edge goes to SmackDown. Edge goes to Raw, but the Edge I would give to SmackDown because they have Roman Reigns. And whichever show has Roman Reigns is going to be the A show because Roman Reigns is the biggest star in that entire company. If Roman Reigns gets hurt, if Roman Reigns gets sick, if anything happens that takes Roman Reigns off of television for any extended period of time, these people are fucked. That's how important he is and his story is to that show. Now, I tried to look on WWE.com for the remaining pool of talent eligible to be drafted tomorrow night, and surprise, surprise, there is none. They have nothing listed because they don't care enough about these things to list them online. Bobby Lashley is obviously eligible tomorrow night, and I hope they did not reunite the Hurt Business for 1 week just to break them up the next. But that would be very much on brand for this company. Kevin Owens would be better off being drafted to AEW at this point. I think he will be. I think he will draft himself. He'll become a free agent, and then he will draft himself over to All Elite Wrestling. But for now, I think Owens to Raw is the move that I would make. He moves every year, so I would be shocked if he wasn't drafted. They treat this guy like the village whore, the way he gets traded back and forth. Why would this year be any different? What's he doing on SmackDown right now that's so important that he has to stay put where he is? He's doing jobs for Happy Corbin, and Madcap Moss. I think Kevin Owens to Raw is the move to make. But if they think he's leaving, if they're trying to shove a contract in his face for an extension or whatever, and he's not signing it, and they think that there's a good shot they're going to lose him, he's not going to get pushed to any great degree. I still think moving him to Raw, though, is the move to make. Looking at the NXT roster, LA Knight. LA Knight needs to be on Raw or SmackDown yesterday. It is a fucking embarrassment if LA Knight does not get drafted, but Aaliyah does. For the NXT women, I think Dakota Kai, I think Xia Li, and I think Frankie Monet could all move from NXT tomorrow night, either to Raw or SmackDown. Dakota Kai for sure. I would be surprised if she doesn't move. I mean, she hasn't made a single appearance on TV since losing to Raquel Gonzalez. You know, and I joked before about her becoming the new human form of Lily when Alexa Bliss comes back, kind of half-jokingly, but I don't know. I'm not completely joking about that. That does sound like something I could see them doing. Xia Li has been absent from TV as well, which is one of the reasons why this whole Tian Sha storyline has just collapsed on NXT. It is just fucking dead. I don't know that she's going to be going back there. And Frankie Monet just lost to Raquel Gonzalez on TV this week. Where does she go from here? She doesn't need to be on the developmental show. This woman has been doing this for a while. She's traveled all over the world. Frankly, she doesn't fit the mold of what it looks like they're looking for now on NXT. They're going with less experience, younger people, people who don't have the kind of experience that she does. She would be much better off going to Raw or SmackDown. Now, this Friday is the season premiere of SmackDown, and it is now official. The King of the Ring is back. And with it, for the first time, is the Queen of the Ring, which they are calling the Queen's Crown Tournament, just to be different. Both tournaments begin on SmackDown this week. The finals of each are expected to take place in Saudi Arabia. I'm not even going to venture to make any predictions on either of these until I know exactly who is in these tournaments. We don't even know what the brackets are going to look like. I doubt they do either. They probably haven't even put them together yet. We'll get them on Friday afternoon. But if I'm wrong and they actually do have the brackets put together, then they'll probably post them 5 minutes after I upload this episode. That seems to be the pattern when news breaks. Do it 5 minutes after Solomonster uploads his show. I swear they do it to screw with me. But you know who won't screw with you? BetDSI. That's who. If you love football, and I know a lot of you do, you better get excited because the NFL and college football is back. It's that time of year, and if you're looking for a place to bet on games, look no further than BetDSI, which has been paying winners for 2 decades. They're a leader in football betting and the perfect sports book. Doesn't matter whether you're new to the game or you've been betting for years. It's the right sports book for you. With BetDSI, you can enjoy live in-game betting. You can bet your favorite teams all game long, including props on almost every play right down to the final whistle. Plus, you get live casino and daily fantasy. Use your sports and pop culture knowledge to make some extra cash. BetDSI also has a user-friendly interface and mobile site that's very easy to use. They have betting options for everything from the NFL and the NBA to the NHL, golf, UFC, politics, reality, esports, you name it. They're top-rated on betting review sites, and they offer the fastest payouts in the industry. You play, you win, you get paid. It's that simple. So if you want to add a little excitement to the sports you love, BetDSI gets my recommendation. Right now, new members get 100% bonus match using the promo code MONSTER100. That's more than double your money to start winning today. Go to BetDSI.com and use promo code MONSTER100 to get this limited time 100% bonus offer. To make some extra cash on the sports you know and love, use Bitcoin and get 100% deposit bonus on your first 2 deposits, up to $2,000. Again, that's promo code MONSTER100. It's only a game until you bet it at BetDSI. This past Wednesday, AEW brought Dynamite to Rochester, New York, 18 months after they were originally scheduled to be there. But that was week one of the pandemic that shut everything down. And Brody Lee did not get to debut in his hometown as the Exalted One of the Dark Order. But they honored him with a great show. Open hot with an Adam Cole win over Jungle Boy, and a hot main event with Sammy Guevara beating Miro to win the TNT Championship. This was the destination I expected them to get to. It just came sooner than I thought it would. After Sammy won the title, Bobby Fish, who recently signed with MLW after being released from NXT in August, he just debuted last night for them as part of their Opera Cup tournament in Philadelphia. Fish tweeted that he wanted the first shot at the TNT title. And backstage after the show, when he was being interviewed by Tony Schiavone, Sammy acknowledged the tweet. He said, "We got people not even working for AEW who are coming at me wanting to challenge for this championship," and he accepted the challenge for Dynamite this Wednesday, which is also going to be in Philadelphia, much like MLW was last night. I like the idea of Sammy accepting open challenges from outside talent, as well as talent from the AEW roster, just like Cody Rhodes did when he had the TNT title. I think it makes things a little more interesting, and you never know who might impress you. That's how Eddie Kingston and Ricky Starks ended up getting contracts with AEW. Their first appearances came in that open challenge, wrestling Cody on TV, and they were signed to contracts right after that. So again, you never know. I don't know what Fish's status is, if he is signed with AEW in some way, or if this is a one-off. When he got released from NXT, it didn't really make a big difference to me. You know, I know he was a veteran presence on that roster, but he seemed to be hurt more than not. He missed a ton of time. He wasn't really doing much. Maybe they see him as some kind of a veteran presence that they could add to the show. I don't think, you know, I'm not clamoring to see Bobby Fish on TNT every week. If it's a one-shot deal, I have no issue with it. But this whole idea of bringing in some names who may not be contracted to AEW to put them on TV and challenge for the championship is something that I think could be a benefit. I think it could be a positive, and you never know who may end up joining the AEW roster if they end up getting in the ring and impressing, you know, I say the right people, if they end up impressing Tony Khan. he's the one who offers the deals and signs the checks. So if you don't impress him, then I guess you're not getting a contract. Leo Rush impressed Tony Khan so much so that he is back and he is all elite. And I told you this retirement would not last very long, and it didn't. Never doubt me. They aired a vignette for him on the TNT on Wednesday. He's going by the nickname LBO Leo for leveraged buyout, because he's a businessman, you see. He borrows money from companies that need guidance and help. He makes profits for himself and for those companies. He's a great addition to the roster. He's very talented. He's still only 26 years old. When he announced his retirement after he suffered that shoulder injury in his one lone AEW appearance at Double or Nothing, he did say that he was going to fulfill all of his remaining New Japan commitments because he had just signed a deal with them. So he's going to be at the New Japan Strong tapings later this month. Beyond that, I don't know if he has any other dates that are unfulfilled for them. He probably does if he only signed with them earlier this year. So I would imagine his agreement will continue as planned with New Japan, but he is officially all elite. Bryan Danielson and Nick Jackson had a very good match on Rampage Friday night. The Fast National numbers for the show, which we don't usually get to see. Usually we have to wait until Monday to hear about how Rampage did, so it was a little odd that we got these Fast National numbers that were being tweeted out. I think Sean Ross Sapp was the first one to post them. The audience for Rampage was 594,000, which would not be a good number at all for Bryan Danielson's first match on Rampage. That is not the final number. That usually drops on Mondays, which is why, again, I was surprised to see this number being reported. Same with SmackDown. When you get a Fast National number for Fox, typically that number will end up being a little bit higher. Even a little bit higher would still not be a good number for AEW. So for their sake, hopefully that's all it is, because there is really no positive way to spin that number. Now this Wednesday, Dynamite is celebrating its two-year anniversary in Philadelphia with Sammy Guevara and Bobby Fish for the TNT title. We have the Elite, Kenny Omega, Adam Cole, and the Young Bucks challenging Brian Danielson, Christian Cage, Jungle Boy, and Luchasaurus. Hikaru Shida goes for her 50th AEW win against the returning Serena Deeb. And only the second casino ladder match in AEW history, the first one since last year's Double or Nothing, which Brian Cage won, I believe in his debut. The winner will receive a future AEW World Title match. We have Jon Moxley, Lance Archer, Pac, Andrade, Orange Cassidy, and Matt Hardy. Now, I know that this story is unfinished between Orange Cassidy and Matt Hardy. Orange Cassidy beat Jack Evans in the final match on Rampage on Friday, which might explain the 594,000 number with Jack Evans in the main event, but he beat Jack Evans, and the whole point was that it was a hair versus hair match. And they did not shave Jack Evans bald, although they shaved part of his head. But he was the stand-in for Matt Hardy. So obviously the issue with Cassidy and Hardy is not over. I just think Matt Hardy in this type of match, you know, kind of a big match, is a waste of a spot. But there he is. He's one of the participants in the ladder match. Obviously, he has a lot of experience in ladder matches. And there will be one Joker entrant. And my money is on Hangman Page, who we have not seen in nearly 2 months. I think it would be the best way for him to circumvent Kenny Omega, saying that he would not give him a championship match by going into a ladder match and winning the right to challenge for the AEW World title. Doesn't say that he has to challenge for it right away. Doesn't mean he has to challenge for it at Full Gear. Although if he wins the shot, I don't know why he wouldn't want to challenge Kenny Omega as soon as possible for the championship. The only wrinkle in all this is that Brian Danielson is in the middle of going through members of the Elite for him to get a title match against Omega. He beat Nick Jackson on Friday. My guess is he'll beat Matt. He might even beat Cole. And eventually he will get that championship match, I figure, for Full Gear. So the timing on this is a little weird. I don't know how they're going to handle it. And maybe it won't be Hangman. Maybe it'll be somebody completely different. Maybe it'll be somebody making a debut that we've never seen before in an AEW ring. But that looks and sounds like the perfect spot for a Hangman Page return on this 2-year anniversary show. If I remember, I think Hangman was on the very first Dynamite, I believe. I think it might have been against Pac, actually. If I'm remembering, I think that was the debut episode. So I just think it would be the perfect spot for him to come back. Now, I did watch the first episode of Roads to the Top, the Cody and Brandy show. And it's what you would expect. It's basically Total Divas, only it's starring Cody and Brandy Rhodes. It is scripted reality. They focus mostly on Brandy being pregnant and how their lives are about to change. And she's adamant about getting back into the ring and winning the women's championship, which, oh boy, if you think social media is toxic now, wait until we get AEW women's champion Brandy Rhodes. I enjoyed the backstage stuff that they showed with the other wrestlers. You know what? It's very similar in that respect to the Total Divas and the Total Bellas shows. You know, the odd times I would check it out, I enjoyed that kind of backstage peek into the madness, you know, backstage at the shows with some of the other wrestlers. I always enjoyed those parts. And you get that with this show. It does give you a small window into what goes on behind the scenes. But you know, and I think that could be the real strength of the show, but that's not what the show is about. You also have your manufactured tension, like Red Velvet complaining about Jade Cargill slapping her too hard in a TV segment and there being heat between them, which Brandy, it's up to Brandy at the very end to resolve the issue at the end of the episode by bringing them together for a wine tasting. You know, I mean, this is like something out of an episode of Full House where Danny Tanner has to bring his feuding kids together at the end of the show. And we have the music playing in the background, right? As everybody ends up being one happy family by the time it's all over. That's basically what that was. And I dislike stuff like that because it's just so obviously phony. And honestly, that's why I don't watch a lot of reality TV. But showing Ricky Starks' reaction after being told that his neck was broken, you know, I want to see, I mean, I don't want to see him get his neck broken, but that's the kind of stuff that, even if that's played up a little bit, that I think would make the show stronger if they were going to show more of that. And maybe they will. But it's not about Ricky Starks, and it's not about Jade or anybody else. It's about Cody, and it's about Brandy. When Total Divas started, if you remember, and if our longtime diehard Sound Off listeners remember, I lasted 3 episodes before I gave up. We'll see how long I last with this. I will probably check out episode 2, but I make no promises about anything beyond that. NXT 2.0 on Tuesday had some decent wrestling, but it was kind of a bore to watch. Look, I got great in-ring action at Extreme Rules. Say what you want to about the booking and some of the hokey shit on that pay-per-view. I could not bring myself in my Extreme Rules review to crap on the wrestling that we got on that show last Sunday. So we had great in-ring action at Extreme Rules, on Raw the next night, on Dynamite, again on Rampage. NXT is no longer a show that can rely as heavily on great matches because a lot of these people just aren't ready for that yet. They're not ready to be on TV. It's all about character development and finding themselves, and gaining experience. And what they're doing right now is they're just throwing a lot of stuff at us all at once. I got a kick out of the campy honeymoon segments with Indy Hartwell and Dexter Lumis and the Garganos. It's sort of my guilty pleasure, as corny as it all is. Electra Lopez beat B-Fab in a hardcore match with tables and chairs and kendo sticks. I said it before earlier in the show, as great of a personality as B-Fab is on TV, she's just not there in the ring. So naturally, she's been drafted to the main roster. So they're going to have to be good enough to survive all that comes with that. Joe Gacy has not been canceled. He referred to all of the attention he got last week from the likes of Fox News and the New York Post for his new gimmick without mentioning them specifically. And he said the ring is still his safe space. He speaks for a generation that nobody understands other than us, the enlightened ones. He said he saw a lot of triggered faces last week in the locker room, but he didn't want to take up too much of our time, and he thanked all of us for giving him this time to speak. So this gimmick will live to see another day, after all. Even after WWE, I said last week, they took down all of the videos, all of the stuff on YouTube and on social media, anything relating to Gacy that they had posted, they took it down. It looked like they were almost trying to hide him. And now it looks like they've had an about face and they're actually embracing all of the publicity. They did a segment in the ring with MSK, the NXT Tag Team Champions, with the merry-go-round of contenders that come out to interrupt. We had the grizzled young veterans first. They were interrupted by Carmelo Hayes and Trick Williams. Then out come Josh Briggs and Brooks Jensen, who just look, you know, this is the second week now with them, and they just look like they're out there trying way too hard to play the role of APA. They don't come across as authentic at all. There's very little, in fact, very little authenticity about this show. Don't be shocked when I tell you a giant brawl broke out. I know, I'm as surprised as you are. I thought they were all going to just shake hands and go to the back. But they all brawled. I enjoyed the match with Io Shirai and Zoe Stark retaining their NXT Women's Tag Team titles over Gigi Dolin, JC Jane, of Toxic Attraction. I thought if Io and Zoe lost, that might free up Shirai for a move in the draft. Her retaining the titles means she's staying put for now, and I am thankful for that. My favorite part of the show was with somebody who wasn't even technically, you know, in the building on the show this week. Bron Breakker, Rex Steiner. He got himself a video feature. We didn't get enough Bron on this show. No wonder the numbers were down for NXT this week. Very little Bron. He called out Tommaso Ciampa. He said his goal is to be the NXT champion. He said he's here to whoop ass, and if that's harsh, I don't give a shit. You want a friend? Go get a dog. I love this guy. I love this. Well, what's not to love? The Tian Sha gimmick is dead. Xia Li has vanished. I think she's bound for the main roster, possibly as soon as tomorrow night. I guess it would have to be if she was going to be part of the draft. Boa actually won a match on this show over Andre Chase, who wears a college sweater when he wrestles. That's his whole gimmick now. But this Tian Sha stuff, it was interesting at first. And now it has just gone on way too long without there being any real advancement in the story. It has, for me anyway, it's just slowly died a death to where I have really no interest in it now. I thought Grayson Waller and Roderick Strong had the best match on the show for the Cruiserweight title. Roddy retains. I love the spot where Waller did a rolling thunder back into the ring and immediately leapt up into a stunner for a near fall. I thought that looked cool, but Roddy just beat Kushida for the belt. Diamond Mine is getting heated up right now. Mr. Waller will have other opportunities in the future. He was not winning the championship here. But it was a good showcase for what he can bring to the table. We had the Lashing Out segment with Lash Legend. So her new talk show segment I referenced last week, which was in her own little studio, pre-taped, with a live audience sitting, out across from her. She was sitting on stage by herself, covering various current events in NXT. This was designed to be very much like a Wendy Williams type of show. It kind of reminded me of the old Talk Soup show in a way, but her being on stage with the live audience kind of gave me a Wendy Williams vibe. This was painfully unfunny. So very much like Wendy Williams. The worst segment, in fact, on the entire show. So whatever they were going for here with this segment, it did not work. Try again, but if we get another segment like this, it might be time to abandon the whole lashing out thing and do something a little bit different with Lash Legend. She's a great athlete. I ran down her resume for all of you on the podcast last week. She's got the athletic credentials in the ring, but the way they formatted this here, this was a fail, is what this was. Kyle O'Reilly beat Ridge Holland, and as he was being double-teamed after the match by Holland and Pete Dunne, the great Von Wagner ran down to make the save. And you know what that means? We're probably getting a tag team match this week. Tony D'Angelo debuts this Tuesday, the same week that The Many Saints of Newark premieres. Coincidence? Forget about it. I think not. We'll see Mr. D'Angelo on Tuesday. And Raquel Gonzalez retained her NXT Women's Championship over Frankie Monet. This just never felt like it got out of first gear. I don't think Monet needs to be on NXT anyway. She would be better off headed to the main roster. Some quick thinking, though, by Gonzalez there at the end when her left strap broke. She had a wardrobe malfunction. And when the referee handed her belt back to her, I like how she immediately placed it over her left shoulder to cover her boob, just in case it was exposed. Quick thinking by the champion. Toxic Attraction came out. They attacked her. Mandy Rose posed with the championship to close out the show. That tells you where Raquel's next program is going to be coming from. I like that they're running with a women's faction on this show. We don't see too many of those, and they're clearly high on them because those three women have collectively gotten more television time than any of the other women on this show. Toxic Attraction has appeared on NXT every week for the past, I think, 4 or 5 weeks, I believe it is, straight. My biggest gripe with NXT this week continue, and it's the same gripe I had the week before, it continues to be too many new faces being presented all at once. And I think the show is suffering because of it. I watched the Broken Skull Sessions with Seth Rollins. Almost 2 hours this thing went. And he was far more likable here than he has come across in past interviews that he's done or on social media. Some of the more interesting takeaways. He talked about his days in Ring of Honor as Tyler Black and working with Joey Mercury, who helped get him a foot in the door with WWE. At the same time, TNA expressed an interest in bringing him in, and he even agreed verbally to a deal after speaking with Dixie Carter on the phone. So he was waiting on a response from John Laurinaitis at the same time that he has this verbal agreement to go to TNA. He's waiting for Johnny Ace to get back to him and let him know if WWE has any interest. Jim Cornette finds out about this. He had worked with Rollins in Ring of Honor previously, and he also worked for TNA, and he knew what a shit show that could be. So when he found out about him possibly going to TNA, he called him on the phone and cussed him out and told him in so many words that that would be the worst decision he could possibly make. So now he's got Terry Taylor calling him from TNA, leaving him messages about signing this deal. Let's get this done, you know, paperwork and everything. And he's ignoring him. He's letting it go to voicemail because he's trying to give WWE a chance here to get back to him. And eventually Laurinaitis did get back to him, and the rest is history. So much like Chris Jericho giving Eric Bischoff a verbal agreement to re-sign with WCW and then going to WWF instead, Rollins did the same thing to TNA. And that caused some awkward feelings when Terry Taylor ended up going to work for WWE. Now, the wrestling business is very small. You know, we love the wrestling business. We're all fans of it. I talk about it every week. You guys watch and listen, and we all love wrestling. But you have to also keep in mind, when you compare it to other sports and other industries and other, you know, forms of entertainment, comparatively, relatively speaking, the wrestling business is actually very small. And you always need to be mindful of what you say to people and how you treat them, because chances are you're going to end up having to work with them at some point. Seth gave Cornette his props here on this episode. He did give him, you know, a lot of credit for helping him out, even though he still has heat, he says, with Cornette over the comments he made about Becky Lynch last year after she announced that she was pregnant. I remember Cornette went off on how stupid he thought it was for her not to wait to have a kid when she was at the peak of her career. And at the time, you know, Rollins was on the After the Bell podcast with Corey Graves. And he said it caught him off guard. You know, those comments were very upsetting from someone that had helped him and someone he knew and someone he respected. And he said it was unforgivable what Cornette said. But he still recognizes that were it not for Cornette, we probably would have had Tyler Black in TNA. And who knows what his career would look like right now. I mean, he probably would have been okay in the end. AJ Styles, Samoa Joe, a bunch of TNA guys ended up in WWE anyway. But is he there in time to be part of the Shield? Probably not. You look at the timeline, probably not. Does he win Money in the Bank and cash in at WrestleMania? Well, not if the Shield stuff doesn't happen. So it changes the entire course of this guy's career, his whole life. One decision. He talked about almost getting fired from NXT. Dusty Rhodes gave him some great advice, which was to just be himself. Don't let other people tell you who or what to be. Stay true to who you are. And he pointed out that as great as that advice was, it was a double-edged sword because it's also what almost got him shit-canned. I mentioned Terry Taylor. He and Triple H are very good friends. And Terry started working there, and Rollins would be in his classes. And he would question things a lot. He wasn't trying to be a pain in the ass, but he would really challenge him and push back on certain things, the way things are, the way things are supposed to be. And Terry didn't like that very much. And that led to Triple H pulling him aside one day, you know, Rollins, and telling him, look, you're being insubordinate, and you could go back to Ring of Honor if you want and do things the way you want to do them, but you're not going to do that here. So he came very close to having the axe fall upon him. And same thing, if that would have happened, who knows how his career would have turned out. The pathway eventually would have led back to WWE. But the Seth Rollins that we see today would not be the same Seth Rollins had he taken a different route. He talked about the birth of the Shield. He never mentioned that CM Punk wanted it to be Rollins, Ambrose, and Chris Hero. But Vince McMahon wanted Roman Reigns, which was the right call. You know, you look back on it, it was absolutely the right call to make. You have the high flyer in Rollins. You have the crazy brawler in Ambrose, the wacky guy. And you have the muscle. If you had Rollins and Ambrose and Hero, there's no muscle. There's no enforcer. The Horseman had an enforcer. He called himself the enforcer. You know, I mean, you look at a lot of factions and there's always that one guy who's, that's the guy you don't fuck with. Well, in the Shield, that was Roman Reigns. They all complemented each other so well. That's part of the reason why it works so well. And Rollins ribbed Austin about his segment with Rock and Hogan at the beginning of WrestleMania 30 going overtime. Because and then Triple H and Daniel Bryan went out there. They went 35 minutes in their match, which left the Shield with like 90 seconds for their match against Kane and the New Age Outlaws. Which frankly, I mean, looking at that match, that's about how long that match probably should have gone. But he said, he was kind of ribbing him and saying, you know, we only had 90 seconds in our match that year because you guys decided to go a little long in your interview segment. He said Vince McMahon wanted to break up the Shield a lot earlier than he did, as early as December of 2013. So with the idea that they would end up getting to WrestleMania and having a singles match with Roman Reigns and Dean Ambrose. And Rollins just said, well, I guess I would have, maybe I would have been the special referee or something. But as soon as he heard that idea, he said, yeah, that ain't happening. And they all pushed back against it because they knew that there was still money to be made from a babyface run for the Shield, which hadn't even happened yet. They had not officially gone babyface yet. And he's right. It would have been insanely stupid to break them up that early. As it is, I think they broke them up too soon. But at least they got another 6 months out of it before they killed it. And then he made a comment that I'm sure is going to ruffle a few feathers. He said that the Shield, in his opinion, and he obviously is a little biased because he was in the group, but he said that the Shield is the greatest faction in wrestling history in terms of producing top money-drawing stars and champions. And I don't really see what's so controversial about that, but everything pisses everybody off these days, so I'm sure that's going to ruffle a few feathers. But all three members of the Shield have gone on to be world champions both inside and outside of WWE. He said the only group that maybe comes close, maybe, is the Four Horsemen. But even with the Horsemen, you had Ric Flair. You had Arn Anderson, who was a great worker. He's a big star. Tully Blanchard, same thing. Great worker, big star in his day. Same with Barry Windham. But none of them were Ric Flair. He said with the Shield, they were all Ric Flairs. I think that's the analogy that he used. I don't disagree with him. There really has not been another group like them of new guys with no prior history on television coming in together like that the way they did on day one in a main event position. They debuted in the Survivor Series main event. They attacked Ryback at the end of that match. And then their very first match was one of the main events of the next pay-per-view the next month, the TLC show that they did in Brooklyn. That was the very first show they ever did at the Barclays Center. And they stayed main eventers for the entire length of their run. They, you know, together with Daniel Bryan, were the glue that kept Monday Night Raw together through all of 2013 into the beginning of 2014. And they all went on to be huge stars on their own. There's just no other group that can say that, where the members were not already stars going into it. I mean, you've had factions come together where some of the members or all of the members, look at the Main Event Mafia. In TNA, they were already main event guys, but you've never had a group like this with three relative unknowns come together and go on to the kind of success that all three of them did. As Rollins said, he wasn't trying to offend Marty Jannetty, but he goes, there was no Jannetty in this group. And for my money, personally, they're the greatest WWE faction in the last, you know, decade plus. So he's not wrong. He talked about tearing his ACL at the start of the European tour they had at the end of 2015, and he had to forfeit the WWE title. He came back 6 months later, and he attacked Roman Reigns after his match against AJ Styles at Extreme Rules. And the crowd went ballistic. They cheered him like a babyface, even though the last we saw him, he was a heel. And this was also during a period where Roman was being booed still by a segment of the audience. Even though he was a babyface, Vince McMahon was just bound and determined to get this guy over as a babyface, kicking and screaming if he had to. And Rollins says that was a mistake, bringing him back as a heel, because the people wanted to cheer him, especially after they had aired this great documentary for him on the network about his recovery and his comeback. He thought for sure that he was going to be coming back as a babyface. And Vince McMahon said, no, we want you as a heel. And he said it was a big missed opportunity. But of course, you know, Vince McMahon did not want competition for his golden boy. He was trying his hardest to get Roman Reigns cheered like the biggest face in the entire company. And if you take Seth Rollins, who now is getting the reaction that he wishes Roman Reigns was getting, well, this is not the person that I want to push in that spot. I'm sure that had a lot to do with Vince being adamant, even though Rollins is 100% right. It would have made complete and total sense to go the other way with it. His mind was made up. He had his meal ticket, and fan reaction be damned. But after that Extreme Rules show, on the sound off, I said bringing Rollins back as a heel is only fine if they do a dramatic double turn on the next pay-per-view, which was Money in the Bank. They booked a title match with Reigns defending against Seth Rollins. That's when Rollins won the championship because Roman was being suspended. Might have been the next day. He got suspended for a wellness violation. And then Ambrose that night cashed in right after. He took the title from Rollins. And there's another, by the way, there's another accomplishment for the Shield that no other faction in history can lay claim to, that all three members held the world championship on the same night. The title went from Roman to Seth to Dean, all in the span of 5 minutes. But I pitched it on the podcast. Do a double turn. The fans would totally buy it and be into it. Do a double turn. Heel Roman Reigns against babyface Seth Rollins would have been money. Or even heel Reigns against babyface Dean Ambrose at that time. But they didn't do it. The next year, Rollins was a babyface, but he was stuck in purgatory with nothing to really do. After the WrestleMania program was over with Triple H, he pitched the idea of getting a run with the Intercontinental title. He said that was his idea. And he always loved it, going back to the days of Mr. Perfect, when he had the belt, and Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels, you know, how it was the workhorse title. He said he knew his work rate and his matches would get him over, and he was right. That summer in 2017, Seth Rollins and Braun Strowman both were the two hottest baby faces in the entire company. You could have had either one of those guys beat Brock Lesnar for the Universal title, and they went with neither. He talked about his match with Brock Lesnar at Battleground, where Undertaker returned at the end. That was to set up the SummerSlam main event in 2015 with Undertaker against Brock Lesnar. So he talked about the Battleground match. Seth had all of these ideas for what they could do. He claims Brock didn't even know about Undertaker returning until the day before. And he hears all of these ideas from Rollins, and he asks Seth, he goes, why do you want to do all of this shit? All the crowd is going to remember is Undertaker coming out at the end. He just wanted to tell a simple story and get to the end. And Rollins was crushed. He thought, how come this guy doesn't want to work with the younger talent? He didn't realize until later on that Brock was all about business. And he says it took him a while to understand that. Case in point, fast forward to their match at WrestleMania 35. Any other year, they're going on last for the championship. But it just so happened to be the year where Becky Lynch was the hottest star in the company, and the women were getting the main event spot. And he was torn, because on the one hand, he's really happy for his fiance. On the other hand, he's totally bummed that he's not getting that elusive WrestleMania main event that he still has never gotten. I mean, unless you count the cash-in, which he clearly does not. He said it's still a bucket list item for him to get his name on the marquee for that main event of WrestleMania. Yeah, I mean, if they keep doing these two-night WrestleManias, he may get his main event one of these years. But the original card at 35 had him and Brock going on just before the main event. Second to last. Which, take it from me, having been in the stadium that night, that would have been a death spot for the two of them. So when Brock found out, he was like, fuck that. And he pitched the idea to Vince of going on first. And it was only about an hour or so before the show that the call was made to open the show with the Universal title match. You know, his attitude was, if you're not on last, you're on first. And it was the right call. He said he had a bucket of Coors Light waiting for Brock in his dressing room after the match, because that's Brock's favorite. And they bonded for a little bit in the back after the match. And yes, they did talk about that match with The Fiend at Hell in a Cell. Austin pointed out that it won Worst Match of the Year honors in 2019, an honor that Austin himself has won. And when Rollins asked, according to whom? Austin didn't want to say Meltzer's name, but he did mention The Observer. I forgot if he said The Observer or The Observer guy, but he said The Observer. And they toasted to both being the worst match of the year. Now for Austin, it was the scaffold match that he had tagging with Terry Taylor against PN News and Bobby Eaton. That truly is, if you've never seen it, that truly is one of the most god-awful matches that you will ever see. From Great American Bash 1991, so you can bring it up on the network and watch it. I believe it was Austin's pay-per-view debut. The scaffold in that match that they used is so narrow. I mean, I get the shakes just watching it, and I'm sitting in my room, you know, on the couch watching that. And if you're afraid of heights, I mean, I don't know. I don't think you could pay me enough, frankly, to go up there and do a match like that. But you could barely move. The platform was so narrow. And, I mean, there's nothing more exciting than a bunch of guys who are clearly scared to death of falling to their doom and just barely moving. Moving in slow motion. Oh, how exciting. How exciting. The scaffold match is one of the dumbest match stipulations ever created. I'll die on that hill. Some people like their certain types of matches. Some people like deathmatch wrestling. Some people like scaffold matches. I think scaffold matches are absolute garbage. I don't see what's exciting about them. I mean, we know what's exciting about them. All it is, who's going to fall? That's what it is. Who's going to fall or be thrown off the scaffold? But you got to have a match before you do that. Maybe it's because I've already seen people be thrown off, high altitudes so many times in wrestling matches anyway. It's like, who gives a shit? As a match, it is absolutely the worst, dirt worst stipulation. I've never seen a scaffold match that I thought, man, that was a great match. Of course, we all know what happened to Jim Cornette in that one scaffold match where Big Bubba didn't catch him. But to be fair, I mean, It was a dumb idea to begin with, and that's how Cornette blew out his knees. But I just think scaffold matches are incredibly stupid. But anyway, Rollins says his vision for the match with The Fiend was very different than what he was told to go out there and do. And as the match was going on and the boos were getting louder and louder, he knew how much the match sucked. And he was powerless to do anything about it because his boss told him this is how it has to be done, and that's what he went out there and did. And he said when he got back through the curtain, he was so infuriated, he wanted to strangle Vince McMahon. And Bray Wyatt responded to a headline about this on Twitter, saying, "Wait until you hear my reaction." Oh boy. I can't wait for that shoot interview. That's going to be interesting. But Rollins says that he had to be physically restrained by Tyson Kidd in the gorilla position from doing something that he would have regretted. He and Vince McMahon, they locked eyes. They were staring a hole at each other. And they didn't say anything. There were no words exchanged. They were just staring at each other. And eventually Vince, he probably realized, you know what, it's time to defuse the situation. He just got up and he left. And Rollins said after he calmed down 24 hours later, they had a civil conversation about things, but he is convinced that had he been able to go out there and do what he wanted to do, and I don't know what ideas The Fiend may have had, because Bray is known to be a creative guy, and I'm sure he had his own ideas for how that match should go. That was The Fiend's very first championship match, and it came a lot earlier, frankly, than it should have. They painted themselves into a real corner with that match. But he says, had he been able to go out there and do what he wanted to do, the match would not have won Worst Match of the Year honors. But he never got into what those plans were. He didn't tell us what that was or what that would have been. Anything other than The Fiend winning the championship would have been a terrible idea, which is why that match probably shouldn't have happened to begin with. But I'm glad he can admit that the match was a disgrace. Sean Waltman still hasn't been invited back for another watch-along since then. I don't think he's done a single watch-along for WWE on any of their channels since his reaction to the post-match. The post-match reaction from Sean Waltman to that is always something I bring it up on YouTube every now and then, and he's asking the same questions all of us were asking. How do you have a disqualification in a Hell in a Cell? Even though I don't believe it was a disqualification, but at the moment, that's what everybody was, and whatever you want to call it. Call it a disqualification or a no contest or whatever. It was a shit finish to a shit match. Everybody knew it, including at least one of the people who were actually involved in the match. That was the first night that I can remember hearing chants of AEW at a WWE show. They talked about the Drip God stuff that he's doing now and how it was Becky's idea for him to start wearing the wacky suits. And they talked about his Black and Brave wrestling school and how it all came about and a bunch of coffee shops that he owns. He's quite the entrepreneur, is Seth Rollins. If anything surprised me about this, it was how open and how often he spoke about second-guessing some of Vince McMahon's creative decisions. It was very striking to me how often his thoughts mirrored the same thoughts that I've had, you know, and that I had at the time that all of this was going on. You know, the same time that people like Rollins and others would say that all the fans do and all these podcasters, all they do is complain. All they do are a bunch of negative Nancys. And meanwhile, sometimes you have to wait a few years, but invariably, we end up finding out that in a lot of these situations, not all, but in a lot of these situations, these people were thinking the exact same fucking thing and they were a bunch of hypocrites. But they were working for the company at the time. I get it. I get it. I mean, I understand why they felt tight-lipped, couldn't say anything. They have to keep their mouth shut because it's their boss. It's the guy who signs their paychecks, and you're not going to publicly berate your boss unless you want to be out of a job. I don't have that problem, which is why I can go off on pretty much anything I want to here on this show. I am beholden to no one. But that's your Broken Skull Sessions recap. If you have a mailbag question, you can email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from. Let's do a few questions here before we get out of here. Hank from Mount Vernon, Ohio. My question is about the talent mass in AEW. I know this is a concern of yours as well. For example, let's say Bray Wyatt comes to AEW. I have no reason to doubt your skepticism around his arrival. But for argument's sake, let's say he does come in. Do you have a reason to believe that AEW can handle the new talent mass? This was a problem I remember you talking about with WWE back when it had a huge amount of talent, and to some extent you still see this with WWE. Can AEW avoid this? I feel that the fact AEW talent can book dates in other companies helps, but I would hate to see talent get lost in the shuffle. Of course it's a concern of mine. That is the risk you run when you acquire talent and don't release any. Very few people have ever been released by AEW. It's about how you maximize your minutes on TV. We know that Ivelisse obviously fucked up her deal. She got released by AEW and she isn't there anymore. Jimmy Havoc, because of all the speaking out stuff. You know, there were a few other people, I think, maybe some ladies who worked overseas. I just credit that to the pandemic. Some of them have already come back and been rehired. But you don't really hear stories about Tony Khan and AEW releasing a lot of people. And that, at some point, is going to become an issue for them. But it's all about how you maximize the time that you're given on television. And so what they have to do is just juggle all of these people on Dynamite, on Rampage, on Dark, find spots for them and just rotate talent out. Rotate them out enough where they're getting exposure on TV, not just on the YouTube shows. Is it going to become an issue? Yeah, it will. It will become an issue at some point. I think they're doing a pretty good job right now of cycling out not just the big names, but even some of the younger, inexperienced names that we don't know about. People like Daniel Garcia, 2.0, Orange Cassidy is kind of one of their guys. He just headlined Rampage the other night. Miro and Sammy on Dynamite the other week. We went through a period of a couple of months where Sammy Guevara wasn't even on TV. And then he started appearing on TV with Fuego, and they were talking about how these guys are best friends, which had never been documented on television before. Maybe in his YouTube vlogs, but never on TV. And all of a sudden, here we are now, and Sammy is the TNT champion. A little bit quicker than I would have done it, but, you know, people disappear, they reappear, and I don't have an issue with cycling people in and out like that, but, yeah, as you acquire, it's like buying a new t-shirt. If you only have limited space in your closet or in your drawer, you can buy new clothes, but if you don't get rid of some of your old clothes, guess what's going to happen? You're going to have a pile of clothes because you have no place to put it. It's the same concept. Dominic from Connecticut. With Roman Reigns currently feuding with Balor, Lesnar, and foreshadowing a Survivor Series match with Big E, do you think WWE is running the risk of overexposing him? He is undoubtedly the strongest act on either show. However, I worry that his overlapping feuds and appearances on both shows may cause his character to run out of steam and lose interest with fans. I wouldn't worry about that at all. You're worried about Roman Reigns being overexposed? Where have you been for the past 8 years? Or 6 years, or whatever it's been. People were complaining about Roman Reigns being overexposed 5 or 6 years ago. Now he's doing some of the best work of his life, and I wouldn't worry about him being on Raw. He might be on Raw a few times leading up to Survivor Series because of the whole theme of the show. Once we get past Survivor Series, Roman's a SmackDown guy. He's not going to be on Raw. He's going to be back on one show only, and he will not feel overexposed. He is the best thing on either show. You could say that that has to do with how great he is or how weak maybe the shows are overall. Maybe it's a little bit of both. I think he's doing great in the role. I'm not worried about that. I'm not worried about him being overexposed. Tay from DC. I was on a thread discussing MJF and someone mentioned how he was the ultimate heel and could not possibly go babyface. I disagreed and made the case that like Edge, he could play both roles because he had the look, the charisma, the character, and the personality to pull it off. Is he the ultimate bad guy, or can MJF turn face one day? I think MJF will be a mega face one day, but that's not going to be any day soon. And I also don't think he's going to be one of these pandering babyface types, maybe more of a tweener type, but he will absolutely be cheered one day. And we'll have to embrace being something other than just a, you know, a heel who tries to get a rise out of people. Outside of Ricky Steamboat, you don't find very many names in wrestling history who only play one role for their entire career. That's very, very rare. Everybody flips at some point, from bad to good, good to bad, some more than others, as we've seen with Big Show and Kane. I think at some point, yes, he will be. Forever is a long time. I think he will be. And I think he'll be super over. Tyler from Denton, Texas. I've seen many WWE fans argue that AEW only appeals to hardcore smart mark fans and not to casuals. I think this is usually a bad faith argument and used to instantly discredit not just AEW, but literally anything that isn't WWE. I've always been very skeptical that casual wrestling fans are turned off by certain types of wrestlers or styles, namely wrestlers under 6'2", a faster, more acrobatic style, i.e. flippy shit, or goofy gimmicks. We've seen WWE utilize all of those things for many years with great success. Ironically, the people who get angry and rant about such things are almost never casual fans, but hardcore WWE fans. It is funny, isn't it, how that usually works? I think these types of fans just protect their own views or project their own views onto everyone else. Do you agree? Or do you think AEW's product can never appeal to the masses, as these people argue? I do not subscribe to that argument. I do think that there is room for all types. There is room for guys who are smaller. There is room for guys who are bigger. I do think that people tend to be drawn to the larger-than-life attractions. But that doesn't mean that that's the only type of attraction that they're into. I personally know people who had fallen out of wrestling They were not watching wrestling anymore. They didn't have any interest in it. They were fans of the Attitude Era and maybe even the Golden Era. Maybe a little bit of the Ruthless Aggression. And then somewhere between then and like the mid-2010s, they fell out of it. And I know a few people who got back into it at the time that CM Punk and Daniel Bryan were on top getting over in WWE. Well, CM Punk is not a huge guy, and Daniel Bryan isn't a very big guy either. He's the opposite of that. But there is an appeal there, I think, to the casual audience if they connect with people in a certain way, regardless of whether or not they're 6'2" or 5'8". If you have the right person in the role, Daniel Bryan was the right guy for that role at the right time, and he got over organically in spite of the company. Company never dreamed that he would get over that way. They didn't plan for it. It just happened. Why did it happen? It happened because of the fans. How many of those fans were hardcores and casuals? I don't know. I don't have the scientific breakdown of the fucking audience at that point. But I'm sure it was comprised of a little bit of both. And I know a few people who were casuals at that point who became diehards again for a few years because of those two people. And I'm only one person. If I know a couple of people like that, I'm sure there were others. So as you say, I mean, WWE has had success with people from all shapes and sizes and backgrounds before. AEW will find that mix at some point. Maybe it's a Darby Allin. Maybe it's a Hangman Page. Maybe it's somebody that isn't even working for them at this point. Maybe it's a name we've never even heard of before. They have Punk and Danielson now. Maybe it's not even them. Maybe it's somebody else. And maybe it just has to do with the fact that wrestling just, you know, is never going to get back. People have these fantasies about, you know, the numbers that wrestling had in the late 90s. They're never going to have that again. You can have a healthy wrestling business without having television ratings in the sixes and the sevens and, you know, tens of millions of people. I don't think we're ever going to see those numbers again. But AEW can find plenty of success, I think, with the casual audience. They just have to hit on the right formula and the right people. Maybe they're on the roster right now, maybe they're not. And I believe AEW has already converted certain people who were not wrestling fans before into watching wrestling. I don't know that it's a huge number, but I'm sure it's not just lapsed fans who have come back because they find AEW exciting. I think they've made some new fans too. How do you measure that? How do you gauge that? It's not an easy thing. That's out of my purview. I don't know how to do that. But I do believe that they can appeal to the masses. Trayvon from St. Louis, on your last episode, you talked about going to those Raws in 1998. Can you talk about what they were like to go to live, as I never got to go to a live televised show back then? How similar was it from a format point of view to present-day WWE? Well, for one, there was more pyro. I should have wore earplugs when I was at those shows. There was a lot of pyro and a lot of just explosions and noise and all kinds of stuff. Format-wise, it's really not all that different. Content-wise is another story. But you would have segments, you know, the shows were very much formatted the same way that Russo and his team were formatting them back then. Because that really kind of ushered in that era of television for WWE. But I mean, you would have segments where someone would come to the ring and have to stand there while they went to commercial and then came back and they were airing a pre-tape from the back, all while this person is standing in the ring in a darkened building looking like an idiot. You know, maybe they did that less in 98, but I was at TV tapings in the early 2000s, you know, where they did that plenty of times. But the atmosphere back then, that's the biggest difference. The atmosphere back then with the younger audience, WWE had a much younger audience back then, a lot of teenagers at those shows, and all the signs and everything. You would look out at just a sea of signs. And people dressed up in costumes, cosplaying as different wrestlers and stuff. I mean, you get a little bit of that today, but not nearly as much as you did back then. It felt like a giant party. It really did. It felt like a giant frat party. And WWE shows today very much do not feel like a giant party. But it is still fun to go to the live shows if you've never been before. I would never tell anybody not to go at least once. The live experience is usually a lot of fun. The WrestleManias grew not to be fun for me anymore. I've been in those stadiums with 80 or 90,000 people. You know, I was there in Dallas when they claimed 101,000. It's awe-inspiring to be part of a crowd with that many people. And some of the set pieces and the stages that WWE has put together, they're magnificent. You know, the WrestleMania 33 stage and the set is going to be hard to top. I think that's still the best they've ever done. I think everybody should go at least once. If you have a chance to go to a live TV event, and not just WWE, AEW as well, but even WWE, if they come to town for SmackDown, if they come to town for Raw, and you've never been before and you're on the fence, everybody, I think, should go at least once just to get the experience. Yeah, with me, with the WrestleManias and stuff, the problem is that the shows just got too damn long. They just weren't as fun anymore. It was a chore to sit through them. As great as the set was for WrestleMania 33, that was the show that broke me. Sitting there for 7 hours as The Undertaker took off his coat and his hat and his gloves at 12:15 in the morning. That was a little much for me. You know, now that they're doing these two-night WrestleManias, which is better, it makes things a lot more palatable, I think I'm over the whole thing. I mean, look, if I did it again, it would be more for the vacation with friends. I always look forward to going to WrestleMania there, especially towards the end. And 35 was the last one I went to, because 36 obviously was at the PC. We weren't planning to go to 36 anyway. 35 was going to be the end of my streak. I think I've been to about 8 or 9 consecutive WrestleManias, going back to 28. And I had pretty much reached my fill. But I always look forward to it because it was the one big vacation I had each year. Got time off from work, get to fly somewhere, hang out with my friends, meet all of you guys. I had a ton of meetup events. You know, that year in Dallas, we did the live sound off the next morning with, you know, 175 people. It was great. I loved it for all of those experiences. Would I ever go to a WrestleMania again? Yeah, I mean, I might, you know, never say never. If they bring WrestleMania back to New Orleans or Las Vegas, I would probably be there. And they will, too. I think they will bring Mania to Vegas, probably WrestleMania 40, maybe? You know, the two times I was in New Orleans were a lot of fun. You bring Mania back to either of those two places, I'll be there. Anyway, if you got questions, email them to me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Don't forget my Dark Side of the Ring review on Onita and FMW is up on YouTube right now. And as soon as I am done here, I am going to be recording the audio for my Many Saints of Newark review. I know some people have asked if I'm going to do a review. I've done some movie reviews before. So we'll do one for that. I know we have some Sopranos fans here. And then we can all share our comments in the comments section, which I'm sure is going to be a dumpster fire, because I've already seen a lot of divided opinion about this movie. But I'll work on that. That should be going up on YouTube later today, so watch for that. One other programming note. I am most likely going to be going live after Raw tomorrow night. I don't usually do that, but because it is night 2 of the draft, I covered night 1 live on Friday. They're going to wrap up the draft tomorrow night. I'm probably going to go live after Raw. So head over to the YouTube channel and subscribe. When the chat goes up, when the streaming page goes up, you can join in the chat. And I'll be live after 11 o'clock when Raw goes off the air. So if you have been waiting for that rare live Solomonster Raw review, this looks like this is going to be the week. Only question is, what kind of show are they going to give me? Because I was very complimentary, I felt, about Raw this week, and that doesn't happen very often. So are we going to get Happy Solomonster tomorrow night, or are they going to betray me, and you're going to get something other than Happy Solomonster? I don't know. Got Happy Corbin, right? We got to have Happy Solomonster. I guess we'll see. But watch for that, because I'm planning on going live. I'm pretty sure I'm going to be going live tomorrow night. And then all the usual streams. Dynamite on Wednesday, Rampage on Friday, so you'll have a lot of content coming your way, as well our channel members on YouTube, and I thank all of our new members for joining over the past week. I'm going to be working on the members-only Q&A, probably two of them. There were so many questions, I might actually do it in two parts. And that'll be going up for our channel members with retro audio and other stuff this week. So, until next time, episode 725, coming up next Sunday. Be well, stay safe, have yourselves a great week, and I will see you back here for more Sound Off next weekend. Until then, take care, guys.
The Solemn Monster Sounds Off.
Monday Night Raw is such an obnoxiously boring, uninspiring television show that if they want a hot shot, a Money in the Bank cash-in, and a title change, and try to put something exciting out there for a change, maybe it'll keep me from dozing off by hour three. The show is fucking awful.
The Solemn Monster Sounds Off, available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesolemonster for Sound Off extras and more. And follow The Solemn Monster on Twitter at Solemn Monster.
Solemn Monster. Solemn Monster.
Put that cigarette out.
Solemn Monster Sounds Off.